Good morning.
Good to see you. I was in Drake last Sunday, Drake, Saskatchewan, and spent the week in Saskatchewan doing some research and traveling around beautiful province. I don't know if anybody is familiar with the tradition of small town Saskatchewan sausage. I think I had that 5 of my 8 days that I was there. And I was made to feel really at home when I went to Drake North Star Mennonite Church last Sunday, and a relative of Ed and Marianne, is it Edith Franson, came up to me and said, "You don't know me, but I know all about you." I asked if I should be worried, but no, it was good to see my parents, and my pages might have a bit of prairie dust in between them. I need to ask Don and Tom one thing. I want to reverse the order of the first two images. Could I show the satellite image for, okay, and then the arrows thing? Sorry. Okay, thanks. I'll tell you when. Neighbors. Gotta love them. 3 years ago, Maclean's magazine ran a story entitled "The End of Neighbors." I think Maclean's likes to be sensationalist. They have these stories about the most dangerous place to live in Canada, and this is the end of neighbors. According to Maclean's and several recent studies, we don't know our neighbors, and we're the worse for it. About 1/3 of Canadians say that they feel disconnected from their neighbors, while half of Americans polled said that they don't know their neighbors' names. One Australian sociologist said that even in an emergency situation, people are hesitant to intrude on their neighbors, while those who participated in a British study couldn't pick their neighbor out of a police lineup. Yeah, think about that. And maybe I'm not much better, because when I went on WestJet about 8-9 days ago, I traveled to Saskatoon, and I was surprised when the man in the seat ahead of me stopped to talk. I must have looked stunned, because he said, "I'm Nathan, your neighbor, 42 Brentwood." And then again, I've been told that looking like a deer in the headlights is kind of par for the course for me. According to this Maclean's article, as a result of isolating ourselves, we suffer from poor health. People who have a tight-knit group of friends who meet regularly have a longer lifespan, up to 15 years, than those who don't, and may have a greater chance of surviving a heart attack or stroke, AIDS or cancer, as well as a lower incidence of dementia. Our lifestyles, housing, and media are designed to ward off the interference of those around us, and Maclean's reports the evolving definition, the modern definition of a good neighbor, is no longer someone who is part of your life, someone you chat with over the fence, a reliable shoulder in good times and bad, but someone who doesn't bother you, either in your enjoyment of your home or by threatening its property value. Our reliance on electronic communication, unless reinforced by actual personal encounters, is drawing us apart from one another. Scholars suggest that we are creating more and more mono communities of people just like us, rather than engaging in encounters with a diverse crowd of people. And here's the first image. This is coming from Wired magazine, 2010. They did a series on racial segregation in American neighborhoods. This is Detroit. The green indicates Caucasian. The blue and kind of pinkish indicates African-American. There's a strict dividing line. One road divides these neighborhoods. They have different satellite photos from different cities across North America in the study. We are creating mono communities of people just like us. Thank you. The article concludes, what brings us closer to people halfway around the world also makes us strangers with those next door. We willingly abandon the bad, chafing aspect of our old neighborly ties, but we have to somehow learn to maintain the good habits of compromise and personal interaction they also gave us. This is interesting, but just wait a minute. Are we really losing our ability to be good neighbors to each other? Was there a golden age of neighbors? And I was thinking about my own life in Saskatchewan, where I'm from. And so I remember knowing my neighbors when I was a kid. I remember visiting the Reimers. I remember Dr. Tratch, who always gave me a toothbrush for Halloween. Yeah. I still have a grudge. Okay. I remember being told to stay out of the Bonnet's garden, who lived next door, and maybe that's why I found myself tethered to the clothesline. I didn't want to be isolated. I wanted Glenda's dad, who was our pastor, to drive by our house and see me playing in the front yard and use me as an example in his next sermon. Small town pop culture. Those were the days when neighborhood dogs walked around without a leash and when I could be found by myself on my tricycle halfway across town. But I have some problems with McLean's perspective. I don't think that being a good neighbor is the property of any one era. As an example, 2 years ago, our neighbor's house burned down, and within a couple of hours, our neighborhood had collected hundreds of dollars, food, and clothing for the family. And second, the studies that I referred to are focusing on Americans and Britons and Canadians, and compassion is not the property of any one group of people. It's instead the result of the movement of God's Spirit and our openness to the Spirit. Let's take a few minutes to look at this passage in more depth. And just to recap, I've got a map of the story to show you. There it is. That picture says 1,000 words. Oh, okay, you got it. All right, good. Let's move on. I want to focus on three things. The question of the lawyer, the characters in the story, and then go and do likewise. So the first thing is the question. Not just knowing, but doing. The lawyer in this story probably is one who studied the laws and rules of the Torah, who is skilled in knowing the right answer to deep questions. Note that his question contains the word do. What must I do? But Luke lets us know that the lawyer is not looking for a reason to act, but really for a reason not to act. His question about doing is simply that, a question in search of the right answer. The lawyer knows the answer already, and Jesus knows that he knows the answer. And Jesus said, how do you read the scriptures? How do you interpret the scripture? What is the meaning here? And with the lawyer answers, Jesus says, you're right, now go and do likewise. But the lawyer responds with another question. He's heard of Jesus as a great teacher, and now he's testing Jesus to see who is smarter. When he asks his second question, who's my neighbor, he's not looking for someone to be compassionate towards, but he's trying to shorten his list. Scott Hosey, Reformed Church minister, writes this. His hope is that Jesus will say something to this effect. Well, very well, henceforth a neighbor, hereafter referred to as part of the first part, shall be defined as meaning a person of Jewish descent whose legal residence is within a radius of no more than 3 statute miles from one's own legal residence, unless there's another person of Jewish descent, hereafter referred to as the party of the second part, living closer to the party of the first part than one is oneself, in which case the party of the second part is to be construed as the neighbor to the party of the first part, and one is then at oneself relieved of all responsibility of any kind to the matters hereunto appertaining. But instead of an inquiry into the way to better connect with and serve as neighbors, the lawyer's question is self-serving. Here's my reference to a pop culture song. T-Bone Burnett sings the song Trapdoor. It's a funny thing about humility. As soon as you know you're being humble, you're no longer humble. It's a funny thing about life. You've got to give up your life to be alive. You've got to suffer to know compassion. You can't want nothing if you want satisfaction. So Jesus doesn't answer the lawyer's question, at least not in the way the lawyer is expecting. Instead, Jesus tells a story. And this is important, because while a rote answer would not compel anyone to action, a story could. Stories draw us in and enable us to find ourselves in them. Stories draw us into their action, not simply into the text of an answer. If Jesus would have simply said, you're on the wrong track, he probably would have ended the conversation with the lawyer. Instead, he draws the lawyer into the story in several ways and then asks the final question. The characters. Now, I want you to think for just a second here. So I'm going to ask you to do something as part of the sermon. If you were in trouble, who would be the last person on earth you would expect to help you? Just think, and in a few minutes, I'll ask you if you were willing to voice this. The last person on earth that you'd expect to help you, and hold that thought. It's not only the fact that Jesus answers with a story, but how he tells a story is very important. Jesus begins, a certain man was walking down the road from Jerusalem to Jericho. Now this could be anybody, this could be you, this could be me. Walking down a dark Hamilton alley when, surprise, surprise, two people jump out of the shadows and beat you up. Having done the deed, they take your money and run away. You're hurt, you can't stand, you can't even think straight. You need help, so you wait for somebody to come along. The first person to come along could be a pastor, You expect this person to help you, but that person passes on by. In the story, the second person is a Levite, and I couldn't quite figure out a parallel to a Levite. Levites were members of the tribe of Levi, chosen by God to serve him in the tabernacle. The Levites were substitutes for the firstborn males of Israel who'd been set apart by God to himself. They were a special type of priest, but the Levite in the story is probably concerned with remaining pure in order to lead the worship in the tabernacle. So if you know jokes, sometimes there's, you know, three stages to a joke and everybody waits for the third stage. So the crowd is waiting, expecting the third person to be the one who actually helps. Will this be an ordinary Jew? That wouldn't be right, because that would show up the religious leaders. Instead, Jesus presents the crowd with the one person who will make everyone gasp. So are you willing to voice who was the last person on earth you thought would be of help to you? Anybody willing to say?
The enemy.
The enemy, yes. Anyone we define as an enemy, thank you. Anybody else?
Donald Trump.
Donald Trump, there you go. Okay, good, okay. Anybody else? That's good, thanks. Well, in this story, it's the Samaritan. Remember, the stories call to us to find ourselves in the story, and sometimes people who read the story identify with the Samaritan a bit too quickly. Debbie Thomas, who writes for the Christian Century, says this: "This is a reversal story, a story intended to upset our categories of good and bad, sacred and profane, benefactor and recipient. If we too easily and comfortably identify with the Good Samaritan in this parable, maybe we're missing the point. Maybe the whole point of the Samaritan is that he is not us." By the time Jesus told the story, the enmity between the Jews and Samaritans was ancient, entrenched, and bitter. The two groups disagreed about everything that mattered: how to honor God, how to interpret the scriptures, and where to worship. They practiced their faith in separate temples, read different versions of the Torah, and avoided social contact with each other whenever possible. Truth be told, they hated each other's guts. They were inclined to love the Good Samaritan. Jesus' choice to make him the hero of the story was nothing less than shocking to first century ears. Maybe he likes the example of Donald Trump helping us. After all, he was the other, the enemy of the Jews, the object of their fear, their condescension, their disgust, and their judgment. He was the heretical outcast. Is there anything we can do in our contemporary lives to recover the scandal at the heart of this parable? Because its heart is a scandal. Think about it like this. We all thought about the last person on earth to save our lives when we're in trouble, and Debbie also throws us some possibilities in her writing. Here's a couple. An Israeli Jewish man is robbed and a good Hamas member saves his life. A liberal Democrat is robbed and a good conservative Republican saves her life. A white supremacist is robbed and a good black teenager saves his life. A transgender woman is robbed and a good anti-LGBTQ activist saves her life. An atheist is robbed and a good Christian fundamentalist saves his life. She writes, "I don't mean for one moment to trivialize the real and agonizing differences that divide us. I dare not do that. Not when those differences have stinging real-world consequences. But the enmity between the Jews and Samaritans in Jesus' day was not theoretical. It was embodied and real. The differences between them were not easily negotiated. Each was fully convinced that the other was wrong. So what Jesus did when he deemed the Samaritan good was radical and risky. It stunned his Jewish listeners. He was asking them to dream of a different kind of kingdom. He was inviting them to consider the possibility that a person might add up to more than the sum of her political, racial, cultural, and economic identities. He was calling them to put aside the history they knew and the prejudices they nursed. He was asking them to leave room for divine and world-altering surprises." And this is important in another way, because if you think about the book of Luke, in chapter 9, verses 52 to 56, Jesus had just been rejected by Samaritans in a community. So here he was putting a Samaritan in the hero position, even though Samaritans had just rejected him. Not only is Jesus presenting the last person everyone would think of as helpful, he's also presenting the Samaritan as embodying Christ-likeness. When I teach my courses at Redeemer, I sometimes refer to a concept that was introduced by Karl Marx called species being. And Species being, for Marxists, our true economic identity, who we really were at our roots. We would make things for our community to use. And here, Jesus is, I think, referring to our species being in a very different sense. Our createdness, who we are called to be. As creations of God, we model God in the world very imperfectly, but compassion is central to our created being and should be our automatic response to those in need. In the story, the priest and the Levite see, but do not act in compassion. The Samaritan also sees and immediately acts. It's not that the first two have things to do and the Samaritan doesn't, because at the end of the story, he leaves to go elsewhere, maybe on to other commitments. And he pays the innkeeper to take care of the wounded person. The Samaritan responds out of his true being, out of the calling of God's Spirit. The Samaritan is Christ-like. This is an act of doing, not just providing the right answer. In the first scripture passage that was read today, the righteous ask, "When did we visit you in prison? When did we clothe you and feed you?" My interpretation of this is that these people were doing these things, but not counting the times that they did them. They are acting out of their true calling to be compassionate to one another without counting the cost. The Samaritan was a hated person. He could have been putting himself at risk by stopping, but in the story, he does not stop to consider this. He sees and acts. True compassion does not obey our social typologies, but it is fueled by God's Spirit, which operates as God wills it to. So the last week I was out in Saskatchewan doing research on how Mennonites had been neighbors to people of African American background fleeing from Jim Crow laws in places like Oklahoma during the early 20th century. And there are stories of great friendship, some of which involve Mennonites giving aid to their black neighbors, and there's a story from the Blue area from the 19th century of a black teacher to Mennonites. But I've also found stories of Mennonites, a couple of Mennonites, who owned slaves. I've also learned the story of one Mennonite boy from Saskatchewan who grew up to found a white supremacist church in the United States and who is still revered as a figurehead in the white supremacist movement. Mennonites do not have a monopoly on compassion. Rather than being a trait that we own, the book of Luke demonstrates compassion as a divine prerogative. Luke uses the term to show compassion as something that God does and Jesus does. And showing mercy, that's something that God and Jesus do too. And so by showing mercy and compassion, we are acting as servants of God. We are mirroring Christ. Samaritan's not only a good neighbor, he's acting as God's agent. And the Samaritan appears, or Samaritan people appear, a couple of times in the Gospels. The only leper who returned to thank Jesus in Luke 17, the woman at the well. By imitating the Samaritan in this story, we are imitating Christ himself. Third point, call to action. The story ends with Jesus asking the question, which of these was a neighbor? The lawyer has had the opportunity to see himself in the story, both as the victim and as the one who passes on by focusing on the right answer and not acting. He responds by saying, the one who showed mercy or compassion. And Jesus' response is, go and do likewise. Be like the Samaritan. Act in this way. Only by living the truth, not rattling off rote answers, will we experience true life. A true neighbor is not simply at the right place at the right time, but instead allows his or her life to be shaped through his relationship with the neighbors. It's not enough to be there. You have to do something. I've got one more image here. And I want you to tell me what you see in this picture. Can anybody name something that they see? Yeah, okay. That'd probably be the victim in the Samaritan story. What else do you see?
A black and white couple on a bike.
Yeah, okay. And? And somebody said a hippie, I think.
Hippie.
Yeah, and what are they all doing? They're passing by. Now, each of these people is doing what he or she thinks that they should be doing. Maybe the minister might be rushing to church. The couple is just going shopping, or there's a a palette, an artistic palette. They're the guys playing guitar. They're doing what they think that they should be doing, but is any one of them stopping? None of them is stopping. This painting is entitled The Good Samaritan as You. The Good Samaritan as You. And I want to conclude with some words again from Debbie Thomas about the situation. She writes, "All tribalisms fall away on the broken road. All divisions of us and them disappear of necessity. When you're lying bloody in a ditch, what matters is not whose help you prefer, whose way of practicing Christianity you like best, whose politics you agree with. What matters is whether or not anyone will stop to show you mercy before you die." And I wonder if then that painting, and the title, The Good Samaritan as You, whether this is impelling the viewer to take the role of the Good Samaritan. If it hasn't happened yet, your encounter on that dark road, it will. Somehow, someday, somewhere it will. In a hospital room, at a graveside, after a marriage fails, when a cherished job goes bust, after the storm, the betrayal, the war, the injury, the diagnosis, somehow, someday, somewhere, for all of us, it will happen. When it does, it won't be your theology that saves you. It won't be your cherished affiliations that matter. All that matters will be how quickly you swallow your pride and grab hold of that hand you hope never to touch. How humbly you'll agree to receive help from the enemy you fear. How long you'll persist in the Lone Ranger fantasy we all cling to before you allow an unsavory other to bless you. "Who's my neighbor?" the lawyer asked. "Your neighbor is the one who scandalizes you with compassion," Jesus answered. "Your neighbor is the one who upends all the entrenched categories and shocks you with the fresh face of God. Your neighbor is the one who mercifully steps over the ancient, bloodied line separating us from them and teaches you the real meaning of good. What shall I do to inherit eternal life? Do this, and you will live."